Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, most on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to another interview in the 10K Collective podcast. Very happy to be in the new podcast focus on a very burgeoning and growing sector of people, which is Amazon and e-commerce sellers who are already established and are benefiting from the huge rise in the volumes and quality of e-commerce. So delighted to welcome back a friend of the amazing FBA podcast, the sister podcast, Connor Gillivan from FreeUp. Connor is the chief marketing officer of FreeUp, and FreeUp is, to put it in simple terms, and we can discuss what this actually means, the place to go for Amazon outsourcing specifically, although I know they're getting broader and broader all the time of what they offer. So Connor, welcome to the show.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Mike. Appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. So we've had you on before, the amazing FBA, but for those who haven't heard from you, can you give us a quick background about yourself, and then we'll talk quickly about FreeUp as well, summarize what that is.
Yeah, of course. So I've been in the e-commerce world since 2009. My business partner, Nathan Hirsch, and I met in college. We started buying and selling products online while we were still studying in college. And then about 4 years after, we scaled that business up and ended up having a team of over 50 people and selling over $25 million worth of product in those 6 full years of running the business. And from a lot of that hiring and frustrations that we ran into with other online platforms, we decided to start FreeUp in 2015. And I've been in charge of marketing, advertising, content, and growth for the business since then.
Great. Okay. So it's interesting that you start off by scratching your own itch, which is so often a great reason for starting a business, that you were scaling up, which is a word we want to come back to, because that's really one of the focuses of the 10K Collective podcast and indeed the masterminds of the same name. Okay. And frustration with the existing things. So that's obviously a very good start. What about FreeUp then? Can you give us a quick background on what FreeUp's about?
Yeah, of course. So like I said, we used a lot of the larger online hiring platforms with our first Amazon business. We used Upwork, we used Fiverr, we used Freelancer. And we found some amazing people, but we ran into a good amount of frustrations as well. We found ourselves spending too much time posting jobs and interviewing and vetting the 20 plus applicants you'll get every time you post. We ran into a lot of turnover. And then we didn't feel like we were supported by those platforms because they were so big, they didn't really focus much on customer service. And so in 2015, we kind of looked at each other and we said, you know, could we create a better way to do this with the knowledge and experience we have from the past 3 years or so? And that's really when we set out to start FreeUp. And the core differentiators between us and our competition is the answers to those frustrations. So the first thing is we receive thousands of applications from virtual assistants and freelancers every single week. We put them through our own unique interview and vetting process, and then we only allow the top 1% into the network. So right off the bat, as a business owner, you're getting access to a much more high quality, selected network of people as opposed to some of the other platforms out there. And then the second thing is, once you post a job with us, we actually have a team that looks at your post, looks at your requirements, makes it available to all of the freelancers on the platform. And then we introduce you to one qualified candidate at a time so that you're not overwhelmed with 20 plus people reaching out to you and trying to set up interviews with you. And we can introduce you to one at a time, as many as you need, until you find that person that's the best fit. And then the last thing is we're just a very customer service driven company. From running a business on Amazon for 6 years, everyone listening probably knows how important customer service is to Amazon and how they measure that with all of their metrics. So that was something we wanted to carry over and really make it more of a hands-on solution than just another software platform that you could hire from.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I have to say that my experience with you is that if there are issues or if you need some response in a hurry, you and Nathan are really responsive personally and have been with other people that I've introduced to you as well. So I have to second with my experience that that is very much how you work. And obviously, yeah, anyone who's survived the bloodbath that is Amazon as a seller knows how obsessed they are with customer service. It's a very scary place to sell to, but it's a very, very good company to model customer service excellence on. So we'll talk about that as well a bit later as well when we get into specifics. So let's talk about, in general, first of all, hiring then for e-commerce sellers. What kind of roles would you first hire for? And it may sound like a naive question for more advanced sellers, but I know people who, I personally know people, not of them, but I work with them in masterminds who are doing about £1 million a year plus, and they don't have any single staff at all, no VAs, nothing. So it's not just for the raw newbies. So if you're going out of that, I presume that having said that, they would have hired photographers and things like that. What are the first roles you might hire for?
Yeah, so one of the first roles for me is customer service. I know it's scary to some people because you're putting that kind of into the hands of someone else, but My reaction or my answer to that is that if you've been running customer service for your business and you've built it up to that level on a yearly basis, you should have pretty set processes in place of how to handle all sorts of different customer service emails, issues, returns, refunds, cancellations, etc. So that's one I would pass off first, just because it's time consuming. It will become even more time consuming as you grow. And it's just something that's happening at all times. So it's a big distractor for you as a business owner if you keep getting pulled into customer service issues when you should be focused on actually growing the business and doing other things.
Absolutely. And I think one of the really bad things on Amazon is because the impact of a negative review can be so big on a single SKU or product line that it's very emotionally distressing to the business owner. And I think actually being one removed from that keeps you focused on, okay, you can't control some things like Amazon being, you know, useless with customer support or them giving, you could argue, too much power to the consumer. So those, because they're out of our control, I think it's very dangerous to focus on them. Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, it's a slightly different thing from the time thing. But yeah, I think it's not just a distractor. It's a wholesale resentment creator, right? And I think the less time we spend bitching about that, the richer we're going to be. So absolutely. Okay, so customer service now. You mentioned this is something we've got to address because it's scary to some people because it's a frontline thing and it interacts with Amazon's customers directly. Now, I do know one person, very smart guy, so it's not from stupidity. He's got a big team. I think he passed $1 million a month mark a while ago with his business, a serious player. But he had an entire account suspended because of some incompetent VA sending an email which was, shall we say, ill-judged or not precisely worded to a customer. They flagged it up and Amazon suspended the entire account, costing him at that point, I think, $500,000 a month. So how can we ensure that that sort of thing doesn't happen?
Yeah, of course. So great question. You know, my two things would be it kind of, you know, make sure you know who you're hiring, make sure they have years of experience working through Amazon before, and even put them through the ringer before you actually have them work on your account. Give them 20, 30 emails of situations that are common and see how they respond. So you can make sure that they're kind of following all guidelines, they understand what Amazon's looking for, and you're confident in what they're actually doing. And then the second thing would be create as many email templates for every single customer service situation as possible. If you know exactly, you know, the 15 most common situations why customers are reaching out to you, and you can have a canned template where the person that's working customer service for you is only editing, you know, the name and a few other things, it's going to allow you to keep everything a lot more systemized and avoid those situations where they're writing the full email and it could lead to issues with Amazon flagging something.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I guess basically that means you can, the problem is going to come then from how you create the emails rather than the implementation by the customer service. But so the onus is on you to write good emails, I guess. And just come back to the point of how many you need. We analyzed this once in a 10K Collective Mastermind meeting because one of the members who's left, not because she wasn't doing well, but because she's basically a digital nomad now. So she could make regular physical meetings in London. But we sat down and planned out, she was worried about customer service outsourcing. And we figured out there were 9 areas in which you'd need templates, and then you'd need a couple of SOPs, standard operating procedures for refunding, replacing, and a couple of other things. It boiled down to not that many different templates, actually. We got it down to 9, I think. I mean, maybe 15 is more realistic if you're taking care of edge cases. But yeah, and also what it forces you to do is really think through exactly how it works, which I think just in the broader front is a discipline that imposes on you, isn't it? Outsourcing seems like you're doing it to get the work off your plate. But I would argue, actually, it forces you to clarify things. Just like this morning, I was speaking to a project manager who I'm about to hire, not so much for the Amazon business at the moment, but for the Amazing FBA, well, for the 10K Collective podcast to launch it. And she was asking me embarrassingly obvious questions like, do you have a launch time scale? Do you have role descriptions? And I didn't have any of that stuff. So the fact of interacting with other people forces you to clarify your thoughts, right? And if you're writing every email from scratch, then you're doing, you know, several hundred thousand a year upwards, you're really wasting a lot of time, right? So yeah, that's the other thing I would say.
Yeah. And just on top of that too, it also gives you personally a checkpoint to come back to, right? So when we create email templates for our business or set up SOPs, we try to revisit them every 3 to 6 months just to make sure that they're up to date and there aren't any issues that are coming from them, or if things have changed in the business, you know, your templates may slightly change. So it kind of keeps you honest too, if you look at it that way as well.
Yeah, I think absolutely. The thing is that there's many a company and quite big ones. I've done bits of temping in big companies over the years, never had a proper corporate job because I'm too unemployable. I think I'm too independent minded, but which is why I love running my own business. But it's one of those things that people create one team somewhere, beavers away, possibly for a year or two, to create massive manuals, and then everyone else just ignores them because they're not usable. So that interaction between a real person and what you think of as standard procedure sort of forces you to look at whether it's usable, whether it's up to date, et cetera. So yeah, you're right. It keeps you honest. I like that way of putting it, because otherwise we write stuff and we kind of think we've done it, but we haven't really, unless somebody's using it. So great. Thank you for that idea. So customer service, as you said, scary, but really an important one. What are the first roles would you hire for them?
Yeah, another one would probably be listing products. And this kind of depends on how much inventory you're deciding to carry. But if you're consistently adding products to your Amazon catalog, it's probably smart to bring on someone who specifically specializes within Amazon product listing. You know, they have a good template themselves for how to create the title, how to create the bullet points and the description, and what other information to include, and how to target keywords so that on search terms, your product is showing up over some of your competitors. They can look at the images and make sure those are good, or ask you for more photos if they think that it could be more compelling and make the listing better. I think a lot of people, they may keep that on their own plate, because they have a standard way for doing it. But for me, I always think there's ways you can improve. And that would be one area where you save a little time yourself anytime you're going to list the product. And then you're getting a specialist who really knows a lot more about it. And you can still stay involved at more of a managerial level. So maybe before it's published, you're able to take a look at it, provide any feedback, or you just give them the go ahead and say, hey, this looks great. You know, let's get that published and keep moving forward.
Absolutely. So I just want to intervene on a couple of things again from my experiences in the 10K Collective and even the £1 million mastermind, where you've got people doing between, I don't know, $1.2 million, probably the lowest level, and several million a year. It's incredibly easy as the entrepreneur, especially when your money's at stake or some of your, you got one of the shareholders, so easy to assume that you're the only person who can do it and you're going to do a better job than others. I would actually challenge that greatly. In most cases, people can really improve their listing a lot because we often do that. If there's somebody who's working on a fairly more basic level, if they're new to the mastermind, we'll often say, okay, you know, you're struggling with optimization and you think you can get a better listing working, and they bring it up and we just check shreds, basically. So there's always improvements you can make. And somebody who spends their life doing that is bound to be better than somebody who spends their time split quite rightly between lots of different things, sourcing and supply chain, going possibly to conferences or masterminds. Yeah. So specialization is another thing that I would emphasize to people if you're scared about it. I mean, even I know people, I take my hat off to anyone who's doing $1.5 million a year with no help, but it's the hard way to do it. And trust me, you are not the best person to do your listings in most cases. But the other thing to say is that creating a template should be your job as a manager. Creating an excellent template and sort of markers of what's good, what's bad, what's indifferent, I think is way more powerful than fussing over individual listings. So I would agree with you massively on that one. So what specific practices would you, because this is something that you're going to have to wean people off this control, what's been your experience with working with entrepreneurs and getting them to work with listing specialists? What's the best sort of approach for somebody who's new to handing that off for the first time?
Yeah, for sure. So it kind of comes back to a kind of a philosophy that myself and my business owner, Nate, we kind of have when it comes to delegating and working through new things and then taking them off our plate. So the way we kind of do it is we ourselves perfect it first. We then create our process for it. And then we go ahead and go through the process of passing it off. So I think that three-step process makes it easier for entrepreneurs to go through and understand and feel confident that what they're passing off is going to be a good end product as well. So as an entrepreneur, if you already know how to list a product, okay, then you've already perfected it, right? So move to the next step. Go ahead and create your SOP for how you create the best possible listing as far as you know. So build that out, build out your template, maybe have a few examples in there as well. And then go ahead out to a site like FreeUp or other places online where you could find an Amazon product listing specialist, interview a few, ask them specific questions about product listing so you can kind of see what their understanding and knowledge is of it, find that right person, and then kind of go through an onboarding process. So share with them your SOP, have them look through it, have them maybe give feedback and ideas of other things that they know and how they could improve your SOP and template, and then have them create maybe 1, 2, 3 sample product listings, give them feedback based off of that, showing, you know, that you guys are on the same page. And then once they hit that final one and you're like, wow, this is great, it's even better than what I could do, then it's time that you could actually pass it off to them and kind of set up a system for managing and working with them on a regular basis.
Okay. And we'll talk about setting up a system and managing them in a second. So that sounds like an excellent process. It's quite, basically, I suppose what you're doing is you're being courageous enough to hand things or to hire somebody, but then you're being thorough enough to go, here's an SOP, and then get them to do an example of it to check they've understood. Because it's one thing to say, and the classic thing, I used to teach English as a foreign language for a bit, and very interesting that the way people are trained in that is excellent, because it was big, you know, multi-billion-dollar-a-year industry, and we were trained very thoroughly. One of the things they said, never say, give somebody an instruction and then say, is that okay? Or do you understand? Because nobody wants to look stupid. So they'll just say yes. But what you need to do is what they call concept check. So, you know, is it this, is it that? Or even better, just have them start and then correct course, because almost certainly you'll find when they start, you go, oh, I see what you mean. No, I didn't mean that. I meant this. And as soon as you actually start, that's when the reality of your communication comes in, right? So we'll talk in a second about the system, because I'm very interested in that as somebody who's not good at managing people particularly. I think communication in the sense of interviews is a very specific thing. But first of all, when it comes to your best guess at what you think you've perfected, I've already implied that getting some input from other people in the mastermind has really helped to change people's view of what they think is a good listing. Is it advisable to get some input from an expert in that area first? So not so much somebody who does it day to day, but somebody who's really world class at this. And is that something that FreeUp offers, or would you just suggest going to, you know, some kind of guru type?
Yeah, great question. So it is something that FreeUp offers. We can definitely help in that area. We have high level experts, and then we have, you know, lower level VAs. So we kind of have the full spectrum of different talent that you can find. That is something I would definitely encourage as well. And it's almost someone that you have in your back pocket, right? So maybe you find an Amazon specialist that has a very good understanding. They've built an Amazon business from scratch before. Maybe they still run it themselves, but they do consulting on the side and work with other business owners and help them build their business. And you tap into them for certain things. So like you said, maybe you think you've perfected the listing process, but you go to your Amazon specialist, you spend an hour with him, and you go through your SOP, and he kind of breaks it apart a little bit and adds in more things so that it really is perfected. And to his knowledge, it's at the highest level possible. So I think that can be really valuable. It's something you can manage with your budget very easily because you're not going to be using them usually on a consistent basis, but it's someone you can always touch base with on certain things, or it's someone that can keep you honest. Let's say every month, maybe you have an hour meeting with them. You just kind of keep them updated on the business. They do a comb through of your Amazon account and give you advice on where they think you can keep improving. So that can be a really great resource to have as well.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I mean, I'm not sort of trying to pitch for the business. I do Amazon consulting, but generally speaking, at the lower level, sort of beginners, and when you get into the more advanced levels, then I plug people into the Wisdom of the Mastermind, which works very, very well. But yeah, it's more practical to be able to just get on the phone or a Zoom call. I do that myself with Jason Miles of Winning on Shopify. And I find it's just, here's the thing. If you're going to spend tens of thousands or even more hiring people, then you might as well get the bang for the buck. And the other thing is the lost opportunity cost. If you haven't optimized, if you can get your listing conversion up from 15% to 18% across multiple SKUs, if they're doing well, that can be a massive amount of money. So it's a question of, before you outsource what you think is good, just interrogate whether it really is good. Because my experience is that there's a lot more work that needs to be happening before you worry about outsourcing a media process. So yeah, I'll encourage anyone to do it, whether it's via free app or whatever else. That to me has been one of the game changers for the members of the Mastermind. So we've got customer service, obviously straightforward in a lot of ways, but a bit scary. So there's high risk, but low skill in some ways. So we need to just be careful how we do it. Listing specialist, what other kind of things would you hire for at that point?
Yeah, I think another good one to talk about is PPC management. If the Amazon business owner is using that to grow their Amazon business. And the reason I say that's a good one is, it's a little bit different from the other two in the sense that it's a skill, it's a specialty that takes time to develop. So my kind of thought around that has always been, I always try to outsource things that, one, is taking up too much of my time and just is below my pay grade of where I should be spending time on the business. And then the second is areas of the business that I just don't know enough about, and it's probably going to take me 3 to 6 months of full-time practice to become a specialist within that. And then that's time I could be spending on other areas of the business where I already have skills and expertise. So I think PPC is a great one that entrepreneurs can look into. They're tapping into this specialist or a small boutique agency that all they do is Amazon PPC. And they can really tap into that and take advantage of that and have that become almost a partner of their business. And helping to grow and scale.
Yeah, it makes sense. And I think that's where a judgment call, like, again, it comes down to the humility to know that you're not going to be amazing at everything. And to recognize, I guess Taki Moore talks about this a lot, your areas of your incompetence, which is kind of easiest to outsource. For me, project management, for example, which is why I'm just hiring somebody now. Competence and what he calls excellence, and then genius. And genius is possibly a bit exaggerated. But yeah, it's quite good to know. I think that most of us have a fairly narrow skill set where we're really, really, really good. And if you're ambitious enough to scale a big business, I think outsourcing to people who are truly excellent when you're just mediocre is a smart move, right? I mean, if you're, for example, got a genius at picking the right product lines, that's really, really valuable. I would strongly argue you should stick to that and just get the PPC off your plate, because there's a lot of people who are good at that these days. And the other thing is that whatever, when you learn it, you got to relearn it, because Amazon keeps moving the goalposts, right?
Right.
So there's quite a few areas where there's more sort of stability and longer term expertise. You know, if you learn it once, you can keep that. But I mean, in PPC, I'd rather have somebody else sweat to learn the latest kind of wrinkles, because they change it a lot.
And just so for someone who's maybe scared or timid to pass that off, a couple things to think about is, if you try to do it yourself, the money that you're spending doing it yourself, you're probably not using it optimally. Whereas if you were to go and spend a little bit more by hiring a PPC expert, you may be spending a little bit more, but you can think about your money actually being used optimally in terms of using advertising and growing your business. And then it's just, again, kind of what we were talking about. It's just another thing you're taking off your plate. You can even learn from that PPC expert as they're working on it for your business. So over time, you could become a lot more familiar with how PPC works. So that money you're paying them, you're almost getting two things out of it, right? You're getting your money more optimally used in terms of ads. And then you're also learning on the side just based off of what they're doing and the meetings that you have with them.
Absolutely. Yeah, completely. And I do know somebody a while ago I was chatting to about, he's got somebody, I think from FreeUp, at least at that point, he was using and said, look, I'm getting a return on investment on it. It's very simple. So I think, yeah, and that's the bottom line, is not being afraid to invest in something as long as it's measurable and you can see there's a return on it. And the thing about Amazon ads, as long as you know your numbers, is very measurable. You know, you're either getting a return on the cost of ads plus the hiring fees for the person, or you're not, right? As opposed to seeing them as separate things and measuring them artificially separately. Talking of which, then we talked about numbers. At what stage would you, I mean, I don't know if this is something you offer, but at what stage would you start involving an outside bookkeeper in the business?
So we, with both of our businesses, we got an outsourced bookkeeper pretty early on, just because neither of us specialize within bookkeeping. It's not something we really enjoy doing. And so even when it was taking us a couple hours a week or a month, it was just something we wanted to be handled by a professional. So I think you can bring in a bookkeeper, you know, pretty early on, but once it's taking up even a few hours of your week or month.
Yeah, that makes sense. And the other thing I'd say is it's just so dangerous to run without knowing your numbers, which is kind of rarer at the more advanced levels. I mean, you get that with people doing a few thousand dollars a month. Sometimes they really have no idea about their profit or loss, but it's unusual at the higher levels. But that isn't to say that people couldn't do a better job on it, or certainly if they're doing it manually. I would really argue that's not, knowing your numbers is critical, but doing the manual labor, I just don't think makes sense above a certain point.
And something off of that too, you don't have to necessarily have an expensive bookkeeper. The way we like to set it up is we have a U.S. accountant, a CPA, who does our kind of year-end tax filings and does the overall strategy and management of our accounting. But then we have a outsourced bookkeeper who's very affordable, very intelligent, knows the accounting software that we use very well. And he works in unison with our U.S. accountant, so that they can keep everything on the same page. But you almost, again, you're kind of using your money in a great way, because you're getting a little bit of a discount on the regular, let's say, monthly work that needs to be done through the outsourced bookkeeper. But then you have a high level person at the top who's overlooking everything, keeps an eye on the bookkeeper and makes sure that everything's good in terms of your taxes and everything else that needs to be considered.
Yeah. And the other thing that I found very helpful when I started an Amazon account, before I even got a bookkeeper involved, so I went to my accountant at the time and said, okay, can you help me set up my chart of accounts in, at that point it was Xero, later moved to QuickBooks, because there's so many transactions fly around in Amazon. If you start off, or if you've got any substantial income, and especially if you're trying to scale up and you've got kind of creaky at the seams or poorly structured accounting, then it's going to be creating so much additional work for your bookkeeper. Possibly the worst case scenario is that they're inputting a ton of data they just don't need to measure because it doesn't do anything meaningful, or the opposite, that the tax authorities really, really want some data. You don't have it measured, and at the end of the year, you've got a massive scramble to look through emails and random PDFs and stuff, right? And we've all been there, me possibly more than most. So yeah, I would really urge people, again, it comes down to hire an expert for a few hours just to get the structures in place before you worry about hiring people to do stuff. I was at least smart enough to do that. I'm not particularly smart at how I ran the system, but yeah, I really think that's something where a lot of people, I mean, some people have the luxury of a financial director that works full-time for their business. There's no coincidence that the businesses that I know that are scaling really fast and doing so profitably have got a financial director really highly plugged in. So I just think, again, if you're ambitious and scaling, that overlooking the accountant piece just because it's a bit of a cost is just really, really short-term thinking. So, let's talk about scaling. So we talked about a few obvious sort of smaller scale things you can do to just outsource it, basically the traditional thing of getting stuff off your plate and freeing yourself up a bit. But let's talk about scaling up. So do you have a sort of particular, This is an open-ended question, so we'll knock it around, see where it goes. Do you have a particular sort of approach to or philosophy to hiring for scaling up in general?
Yes, absolutely. So in terms of when we're scaling and hiring, the way we do it is a lot of it comes down to those financials, right? And it builds perfectly off of what we were just saying. If you don't have good financial bookkeeping, it's harder to make those decisions. So for us, when our financials look at a good enough place and we have enough profits to reinvest into the business, we're looking for areas of growth. And the way that we do it is very much on a trial and error and a testing basis. So, you know, we may identify 1, 2, 3 different areas of growth that we think could help scale the business and bring in more clients and help us bill more hours through the business. And we'll slowly invest into each of them, whether it's us first spending that time working on those areas, or if we have to get an app to help us go ahead and try it out, or if we hire a specialist. That's another way of investing and kind of testing those things out. We'll usually run tests on those areas of possible scale for 1, 2, 3 months, depending on what it is, and try to really measure the results to see how they're impacting our overall financials and overall growth. And then for the ones that are really working, we'll go ahead and push forward with them, either stay at the same investment that we did to start or increase it a little bit. And for the ones that just didn't perform as well, we'll slowly scale those back or just completely cut them out so that we can try other ones and find the ones that are really home runs for us.
Excellent. That makes so much sense. And I've been reading a lot of Jim Collins books recently, or listening to the audio books, in some cases both, getting a bit obsessed with that again. But one of the things he's talked about recently is Great by Choice, what is one of his later books, which is about not just the companies that made, you know, grew and became great in financially in terms of customer service, et cetera, and products, but also the ones that did so in very unstable industries. So one of the classic examples, Southwest Airlines, which in an industry where nobody makes consistent profit and a lot of them go bankrupt, has made profits for the last, whatever, 40 years in a row, which is crazy, including 9/11, everything, you know, the early 70s with the price hikes and in jet fuel. And Microsoft is in there as well, and in the era when Apple was pretty weak because Jobs had left. And that kind of thing. And one of the habits they have is, he says, he call it fire bullets and then fire cannonballs. So in other words, they test at a small scale, and then they only invest in stuff that's got a proven, empirically proven, i.e. that looks at the numbers and it's actually success. And he said that the difference in success failure rates is just massive. So what you're doing is really textbook stuff. I mean, that makes a lot of sense to me. Are there particular areas in Amazon where you see, rather than just sort of outsourcing day-to-day stuff we've been talking about, where you've seen growth for clients by outsourcing or involving people in new areas?
Yeah, I mean, there's different ways to scale an Amazon business, right? So it could be, do you try to increase sales for your current inventory and current products? You can do that kind of with some of the ways we mentioned before, whether it's improving your listings or your keywords or your Amazon PPC, and kind of seeing what comes of that. And then there's the option of trying to source new products and find new opportunities where you think you could get sales with a different type of product and try to scale in that way. So I've seen it go both ways. I personally think it's smarter to test out increasing sales for your current inventory before starting on something new, just because if you're already seeing some sort of sales and some sort of sales growth with those current products, there's probably still more water, so to speak, that you could squeeze out of the sponge. Whereas going with a new product, it's just a lot riskier, right? You may try 5 new products and invest a bit more than you would in products that you already have, and maybe one of them works out. So yeah, I mean, there's those two kind of disciplines or ways that you could go about it, and you can always involve people in the process if you want to as well.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think I would agree with you that improving existing products, I mean, I was just working with somebody who's coming into the 10K Collective Mastermind, and we talked through things in an interview before he came in. I said, okay, so it sounds like, yeah, you need to hire staff to scale up. But before you do that, the first port of call is optimizing existing listings, improve the profits without much extra cost. That gives you then the cash flow to start hiring in people to then expand into new product lines, et cetera. So yeah, that makes total sense, right? It all comes down to cash flow a lot of the time, doesn't it? It's kind of that brutally simple. So again, coming down to measuring the financials properly. So yeah, it all ties in beautifully, which is good because that was another question that I'd really planned with you. And assuming that, you know, we have some ideas of outsourcing, then while one major question is if we're using staff to scale up, the question of outsourcing versus in-house, because it's obviously quite a big question because some we see successes in both ways and failures as well. What are your sort of thoughts on that? Obviously, I realize you're biased as any intelligent listener does because you do outsourcing, but what's the comparison between the two? What are the pros and cons of each?
So there's definitely pros and cons of each. I think a lot of it also comes down to your personal preference as an entrepreneur and business owner, and just how you want to personally run your business. But in terms of outsourcing versus in-house, I think in-house, the pros are you're working with someone directly there. Most of the time, they're going to be full-time. So you have someone full-time directly invested into the business, and they're going to be able to learn your whole company and help in different areas and almost become a partner to you in a sense. So those are kind of the great things. The cons I would say of someone in-house is you just have more overhead. So you have less freedom in terms of cash flow to experiment with things. And then I personally think when you hire someone full time, you're more getting a generalist rather than a specialist. So they're going to be good at a number of different areas of your business, unless you just hire them full time to do one specific thing. But then that's kind of a pretty large expense. So those are some kind of thoughts on in-house. Outsourcing, you of course can kind of get economies of scale where you save money by hiring people for specific roles for only certain hours. You don't have any of the overhead of employees, whether it's the office or health insurance or paid vacations, things along those lines. And I really like it because at any time in the business, you're never too dependent on one specific person. You may have, someone doing your product listing and they're working 4 hours a week. You may have someone doing your PPC and they're working 10, 15 hours a week. You have someone doing customer service, but maybe you have two people on customer service. So you always have variety there. And the other great thing about outsourcing is it's always, you can stop and go. If your business somehow hits a halt, you can pause a few of the freelancers that you hired and lower your internal costs until it picks back up. And then you can bring them on for more time. Whereas full-time in-house, you're kind of stuck with that set overhead per month based off of the salary that you set them up with. So those are just some general thoughts there. Happy to answer any other questions you had off of that too.
Yeah, excellent. Well, those make a lot of sense. I mean, I think it comes down to that fire bullets, then fire cannibals thing. I mean, even if you're going to eventually hire in-house, which is, has many pros in terms of being more, invested, more of a partner, more of a permanent presence. But yeah, I think it, in terms of the vulnerability of business, particularly something as volatile in terms of sales, even if it's a well-run, even if it's an excellent Amazon business. I mean, it's very, very seasonal retail generally, isn't it? Particularly in certain categories like toys and games is crazily seasonal. So it makes sense to have a certain degree of financial flexibility just to make sure you don't end up with that death of the business by running out of money. As somebody put it, the only way a business dies is running out of money. So having variable or flexible overheads is absolutely critical to help that. So let's talk about management then. So we talked about what to outsource. We talked about some of the ways to hire people or to get them on board. And we're not going to really talk about big onboarding because I guess in a sense, you guys do a lot of that. We could talk about that in depth. Let's talk a little bit about hiring briefly, but let's talk about managing. I'm just geared to the idea of a project manager because I'm just hiring one. So let's talk about that. Is that somebody you would hire? And at what stage would you do that?
Yeah, great question. Project managers can be amazing. They're kind of that level of management below you and a number of other people in the business. And it kind of takes time away from you having to do the daily management and keep people honest in their roles. I think it's a good time to hire a project manager after you have, let's say, 3 to 5 people that you've hired. And because at that point, it's just a lot of daily management in terms of, you know, checking in with each of those people, assigning them new tasks, meeting with them to keep up with them and make sure they're on track for their goals and deadlines. And that can, I mean, it can just start to take a lot of time up in each day. It may be, you know, a couple hours, but if you hire a project manager and you're able to just disseminate goals, information to them on a regular basis, and they're the ones that's checking in with each of the people and then sending up that information to you in a daily report, it saves you a lot of time. And if you can find a good project manager that you like a lot, and that is very organized and kind of works in the same fashion as you, it can be a really powerful role to have within the business.
Yeah. And the other thing I would add to that, and, you know, many of the people listening will be much more organized people than me, but I mean, I don't think I'm completely incapable of management, but I'm saddened and humbled to realize that, having spoken to a project manager this morning, he just asked a couple of basic questions like, okay, so for this 10K Collective product launch, for example, podcast launch, which is very similar in some ways to a product launch on Amazon, having done multiple ones of those in my time, that, okay, have you got a timescale for this? Have you got a timetable with milestones? Like, the answer was no. Have you got a role description for the people you want to hire to help you with this? And like, the answer was an embarrassed no again. So frankly, once again, I would challenge the idea that you're the best person to run your business in some ways. I mean, certainly if you can find somebody who's a natural project manager, that can really free you up. And there's one person that I know in the 10K Collective, who actually been in Power Mastermind now, who he's got one person who brings it, he brings along to meetings, and her job is basically to catch millions of ideas. He comes back from the meetings with a ton of things to implement. She catches it, organizes it. He sort of fires off a crazy email at 8 a.m. and then goes out for a run or something. And then she organizes it so that when he hits the office about 10, 11 a.m, then she's organized it and started to delegate it. And that makes a lot of sense to me, because some people are just very creative and not good at managing, and some people are great at managing and not necessarily got the sort of crazy drive that it takes to drive a business forward. So it's a personality type sometimes, right? Or skill set. So it's not just, and once again, I just want to emphasize, none of this stuff is just about, I could do it, but I'm getting rid of it because I'm saving time. A lot of it is, this person's going to do it better than you. And if you're not sure if that's true, try it. So anyway, or maybe it's just me. So you're talking about then finding the right person, obviously somebody who's really organized and whose approach gels with you. When the next, obviously, question is how to find that person and how do you select that person?
Yeah, of course. I mean, so you can use any online hiring platform. FreeUp is obviously an option. You can go through your network and see if anyone else has worked with other project managers that they really like in the past. You know, there's a number of ways you can use different platforms or your network to find people. When it comes to actually interviewing and choosing that right person, the way that I usually break down my interviews focuses a lot on who that person is, after I realize that their skill set is actually there. So if I interview them enough or ask them enough questions where I can tell that they're organized, they've worked with other people in a project management role, you know, I feel satisfied in that aspect of them being able to actually complete the work. But then it comes down to, this is someone you're going to be interacting with on a daily basis. Are they someone that has the same values as you? Are they going to be as committed to the business as you are? If you're fast paced, are they okay with that? Are they fast paced? So asking questions around who they are personally, what they care about, what their values are, what's most important to them, that can give you a really good idea of if you guys are going to gel together as you work with one another. Because the last situation you want is you find someone who's really good at project management, but you guys just don't really get along. A relationship doesn't really develop. And I think that can hold you back over the long run.
Excellent. That makes sense. So let's talk. So we talked a little bit about hiring thing, but assuming that we'll skip over that for the moment because they're using FreeUp or something like that. So let's talk about managing staff briefly, because obviously there's a huge area. What would you say are the biggest mistakes that you see freelancing, because obviously you deal with so many freelancers every day and e-commerce entrepreneurs. What are the biggest mistakes that e-commerce entrepreneurs make when they are managing outsourced staff?
Yeah. So I think one of the biggest ones is just they don't really have a system or a way to actually go through the daily management with someone that's remote. If you have someone in the office, it's a lot easier to pop over to their desk and have a conversation with them to get an update or see what's going on. When someone's remote, I see a lot of people that are hiring remotely for the first time, they kind of hire that person and just assume that they're going to do everything perfectly. And, you know, maybe they forget to check in for even a full week or 2 weeks. And they're surprised that everything isn't as perfect as they wanted it to be. So I would say that's probably the biggest mistake, is just not doing those check-ins as they should and being a good remote manager.
Yeah. And by the way, I full disclosure, I mean, even with some of your employees, I've used a wonderful bookkeeper with you guys, who I think was a very sharp, competent guy, but I'm ashamed to say, in exactly that way, I'd fire a task at him and then be out of touch for ages and then go back and go, why isn't it done? That always terrible. And I did apologize quite a lot to him, because I knew I was being a bad manager. But the trouble is, you get caught up in running around doing stuff and hard to manage. So what's the sort of, for somebody who's relatively new to outsourcing, what are the simpler solutions that aren't going to take a ton of time? Because there's always that chicken and egg thing, isn't it? I really need to outsource because I'm too busy, but because I'm so busy, I can't manage the person properly. So how do we square that circle?
Yeah, of course. So for me, it's all about setting the correct expectations up front of how you want that management and communication to happen. So for me, anytime I hire someone, I'm not expecting that I'm going to be personally checking in with them every day, but I set an expectation that they're responsible for checking in with me anytime they start and end work for me. So if I have them set up on a regular 2 hours per day that they're working on something, anytime they sign in and they start working on that, they should be sending me a message on Skype. Hey, Connor, I'm getting started with this work. I'm going to be working on XYZ today. I'll be here for the next 2 hours. If you have any questions, let me know. And then at the end of those 2 hours, hey, Connor, I was able to complete, 5 new product listings today. Here they are for you to review them. Send me any feedback once you get a chance to look at this. And for me, even if I'm busy during those 2 hours, at the end of the day or at the beginning of the next day, I can kind of put myself in a schedule where I kind of check those updates from the people that are working with me. I communicate with them as I need to. And then if you have them on a regular set time that they're working, you also know when they're on. So you can catch them there. You can ask them questions or kind of give them more guidance on what they're doing. So I think that expectation right there, just setting it so the ball is in their court to be following up with you, it just makes it a lot easier on your end, and you're constantly getting those updates, and then you can kind of react to them as you can and as you have the time to.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's really, really good. And that's exactly how I didn't do it last time. So that's a good learning. The other thing you're implying is have people on regular set time for working, which being, people obviously, there's so many myths that knock around about e-commerce. But one of the things is that it's great to be able to just work in your underwear from home. And my experience is, yes, I can do that, but that's actually a very bad thing. One of the virtues of an office is you've got a physical location you travel to, and you've got a set timetable, and you've got somebody checking in with you and keeping you accountable for doing it. So for me, anything that goes back towards regularity and routine is actually really helpful. So the idea of having people on a regular set time, 2 hours a day, but maybe it's Monday to Friday, like 10 a.m. to midday Eastern time or GMT or whichever time zone, they're very, very helpful. So thank you for that very simple idea. Now, tell me a bit more about some ideas about management sort of processes and rhythms. And that's one very simple thing, is that sort of daily check-in. Do you believe in sort of more often having weekly and monthly meetings and things like that? What's your sort of thought on that?
Yeah, of course. So I do. So once you get to, let's say, again, that 3 to 5 people that you have on your working with you, I like to set up weekly meetings, kind of all hands meetings, where you find a time, everyone can come to it, and that's your opportunity to be the leader, right? So you're going to share updates on what was achieved in the past week. You're going to welcome any new people that you've hired and introduce them to everyone else. And you're going to share goals for what's coming up in the next week. And then you're going to ask the people that you've hired for them to share their updates from the past week as well, so that everyone's on the same page. It's that one opportunity where you're all together remotely, and you can keep them motivated and make them feel like they're a part of something. They're not just a a distant person working on one aspect of this business, but they never get to learn anything else about what's going on.
Yeah, absolutely. And one person who's doing really well, Ashley Pierce, who I'm also interviewing for the podcast, who's an e-commerce entrepreneur, and he refuses to use the word VA, and he always corrects people when they use that. He says, team member, don't hire VAs, hire team members, which I think is an important distinction and makes a lot of sense, because that feeling of shared ownership, I mean, one of the things that is so clear to me, both with VAs, but also with myself, is that money is just not a big enough motivator. It may seem like it would be for an entrepreneur, but it never is. Having recognition from your peers is critical. It's another reason why people come to masterminds, because they can go out and kind of do a humble brag, you know, and say, well, I'm so grateful that I made $1 million this month. I'm like, dude, you're just bragging and that's absolutely fine. Let me buy you a beer, you know? So I think that's critical for all of us. And again, people overlook that easily. What about monthly meetings or sort of bigger, bigger rhythm meetings?
Yeah. So we have that, the weekly going on at all times. We do big quarterly meetings per team. So we have those goals for the quarter. We share those. We continue to talk about those throughout the quarter. And then at the beginning of each one, we'll have another meeting with everyone and go through new goals and kind of what we're working towards. And then every quarter, we also do one-on-ones with each person on the team to share feedback, to give them an opportunity to voice any opinions or feedback or issues that they're experiencing. And then to also just kind of praise them a little bit, you know, thank them for being involved in the business, for all of their hard work, and also give them some constructive feedback on how we think they can keep growing. And if there's resources we can provide to them, we share those as well. But it's really just that opportunity to say, hey, you know, I care enough about you being in this business that I'm going to give you an hour so we can chat and you can share anything and voice your opinions.
Yeah. And that's really, really important. I've noticed also that Nate's got a great habit, because it's obviously your business is growing pretty fast. He's got a great habit of checking in with me as a client as well, which is not the same thing. And I recognize as a motivation for somebody who might give you money, but nevertheless, it's pretty rare in my experience of people who provide services to me that they actually take the time, just drop me a Skype and say, oh, is there anything I can help with? And quite often there is, actually, because I've had on the back of my mind, I've had, you know, I really need to hire a bookkeeper, for example, as I did a while ago, even though I probably managed them atrociously badly. That was entirely my bad. I think they seemed excellent at the job. So look, we could talk for hours. I'm aware you've got to dash off and do other things. So a couple of things. First of all, obviously, if people want to get hold of you and find out more about FreeUp and what they do, the obvious question, but it's got to be asked, where do they go to find that out?
Yeah, of course. So you can go to freeup.com. It's FreeUp.com. And then Nathan and I both also open up our calendars to anyone that wants to speak with us. So right on the website, you can access either of our calendars and set up a 30-minute call just to chat or ask us questions or kind of get advice about outsourcing. And I'll also give those to you so you can include them in the show notes here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can also email me at any time. It's just Connor, Connor, @freeup.com. And I'm happy to, you know, chat with anyone or answer any questions.
Excellent. So remember three E's, guys, freeeup.com. And final question then, what are your, if you had to distill all your knowledge about outsourcing for e-commerce into one, two, or three pointers, what would those be?
Yeah, that's a good
question. Brutal question.
Yeah, for sure. I think for me, when I was first running my Amazon business and made the transition to outsourcing and hiring people, it was much less about how do I do this and much more about the mental challenge of actually getting over me doing everything and being able to trust someone else. So I think that's your first thing is, you know, come to terms with yourself that in order to grow your business past that $1 million mark, maybe you're going to need other people. And the people out there, there's a lot of smart people. They'll be able to add value to your business where you can, and it can keep you focused on where you do add the most value. So kind of keep that in mind first. And then the second thing is just start slow. You know, if you're uncomfortable about it, or even if you're confident about it, find one person, hire them, have them work 5 to 10 hours per week for you. Understand what your management, leadership, communication system looks like, and perfect that with that first person. And then slowly hire in other areas of the business. You know, I think that's a much better approach than trying to go all in and hiring multiple people, and then it kind of backfiring and you feeling like it wasn't a good experience. So start slow, slowly and gradually grow as you see the business grow, and then kind of take it from there.
Yeah. Grow when you've got it. You've got your systems sorted. Yeah. Makes sense. That these are excellent pointers. I mean, they, you know, it's a brutal question, but you've dealt with it beautifully. So thank you, Connor, very, very much for coming on, sharing your thoughts and your wisdom on the outsourcing topic, and hope to get you or Nate back on the podcast later in the year to expand on this ever, ever exciting and ever interesting area in business.
That'd be awesome. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. Thanks so much for coming on.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.